Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome back, SBC Nation. Today's episode is sponsored by the man himself, Stephen Fox of foxandsons.com, the finest darn coffee beans you are ever going to find anywhere, especially on the internet, especially sponsored by this podcast. You really got to check out Fox & Sons. Go to foxandsons.com, foxandsons.com. The only way I can get the power to do 90-minute interviews like the one you're going to hear today with Chris Knowles, who's been on this program before. This is a conversation I had with him a few weeks ago. I'm sharing it with you today because this is his capper. This is his sort of farewell to the age of superheroes, which he does see fading away. Not the age of comics, by the way. Not the age of graphic novels. That will go on, but he does believe the age of superheroes has passed, is passing, is moving on. But you got to listen to this interview while kicking back with that Fox & Sons. So I want you to use your discount code, SECONDPRINTPOD, over at foxandsons.com. Get yourself 15% off your order. Grab yourself a cup of Joe. Enjoy the show. My guest today has already become a pretty familiar face here in this program's short existence. He is the proprietor of the Secret Sun blog, head professor at the Secret Sun Institute of Advanced Synchro Mysticism. I really love saying that word. He is the author of several books, including Our Gods Wear Spandex, A Secret History of Comic Book Heroes. And he is now kind of wrapping up that superhero arc, you might say, with his latest book just released, The Spandex Files. I am very pleased to welcome back Christopher Knowles. Chris, welcome back.
Thank you, Mark. Thank you.
Well, Chris, last time you were on here, we talked about a lot about your history in the comic book industry, how you got interested in comics. We don't need to go back into all that. I'll link to the that episode in the show notes. But I kind of want to just find out more of what the impetus was for returning to the topic with this book. What did you feel need to be said that wasn't said in Our Gods Wear Spandex, I think over a decade ago?
Well, yeah, it was over a decade ago. I wrote that book in 2006. So kind of a lot has changed since then.
I'd say so. I think that's safe to say.
Well, also, this book, I wanted to concentrate more on like the movies and such. You know, there's a huge part of the book that's looking at all superhero movies and, you know, comic book inspired movies, you know, Matrix, Dark City, mm-hmm. so on. And I wanted to, it was kind of almost like a before and after, but I also sort of want to just draw a line in the sand and say, you know, this is the end of it. This, you know, the phenomenon, the social and cultural phenomenon that I was talking about in Gods Wear Spandex is over. And, you know, the numbers bear that out, that superhero movies, especially this past year, flopped across the board. I think the only movie that did well was the Guardians of the Galaxy, and that's the last one. So it's not even like they can go back to that well. The Flash movie lost, like, you know, they say in like $200 million, and always add like at least $25 million to these numbers. Right. You know, when they say they lost $200 million, they lost $225 million, if not up. I mean, whatever. It's over, and it's inevitable. You know, nothing lasts forever. You can't have that kind of cultural dominance forever. People just get tired of it. I think people got tired of the superheroes. I stopped watching those movies 10 years ago. You know what I mean? I just got so sick of the formula. It just started to feel oppressive, you know? Because especially when it's an origin story, these movies are all exactly the same. And, you know, Marvel had a nice formula. But the problem was is that they just drove it into the ground. And then they thought that they could take that same formula and apply it to all these second, third, fourth tier characters that have no track record of success in the comics. And it didn't work out. And so we are at the end of it. And I do talk a lot about how there was the entrance of a whole generation of cultural studies types into the industry, that just kind of destroyed it. And then there were all the sort of like the DEI and ESG and CRT and all these kind of corporate diversity agendas that just sucked all the life out of it. You know, people watch those movies to get away from that shit. They don't want to go to the movies and get lectured on.
And they're not coy about it either. Disney actually has some kind of behind the scenes specials on its channel. And some of them will have interviews with these writers. And a lot of them will openly brag about how the fact that they have no affinity for the comics. Many of them haven't read the comics, and they're proud of that fact. And they say they're there specifically to, give a voice to the downtrodden and whatnot, and the list of 27 oppressed, oppressed peoples and whatnot. So it's not coy or subtle whatsoever.
No, and I think that superheroes were going to end anyway, and I think if you ask most people, they sort of saw Endgame, like that was the end of it. That was like Return of the King for the Lord of the Rings movies. That sort of ended the story. Where else do you go? And then they took all these characters, like, I mean, you're a comics guy, Shang-Chi and the Eternals and She-Hulk and all these like characters that sort of were introduced in the 70s because, they were trying to keep the thing going because, the older characters were getting kind of worn out. But those characters, they weren't successful back then. They weren't successful in the comics back then. I was a big fan of Master Kung Fu, Shang-Chi, but, I was in the minority. That was not a successful book. It had a certain cachet because the whole Kung Fu martial arts, everybody was Kung Fu fighting kind of deal, was popular in the 70s, but I don't know. And then Marvel did all this, race and gender swapping and sexuality swapping with all their main characters. And that just really, that was the death stroke. That killed the goose that laid the golden egg. But here's the thing. So I remember this is before, the whole, all the diversity and DEI and all that kind of stuff became so dominant. I remember it was sort of started to bubble up. There was a site called Comics Alliance that, they were getting very woke, quote unquote, and Comics Beat. And I remember, I forget which, it was one of these sites, and I commented and I said, this industry lives and dies off of middle-aged single white men. If you alienate them, you have nothing left. That's your core.
Go to a comic shop. That's who's there.
Exactly. So, I mean, you can try to expand your palette, right? But if you mess with those guys, you're dead in the water. And those guys are the ones keeping the stores open. And that's why we've seen, for God's sake, Jim Hanley's closed. You know what I mean? I guess Midtown Comics, I'm talking about New York here. I guess Midtown Comics is still open, but it's just been a bloodbath. You know what I mean? Store after store after store is just dying. The thing is that comic books are more popular than ever as a medium, but it's not superhero stuff. It's all manga and YA. So it's just over. And I kind of wanted to, both for myself, since it was such a part of my life for so long, such a central part of my life, I kind of wanted to sort of wrap it up and say goodbye. You know what I mean? But also kind of let everybody else know that it's time to say goodbye, And I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing because we do have, 80, 90 years of material to pour through.
You can become a comic fan today and just read good stuff from the past and never get to the end of it.
Yes, exactly. And, the metaphor I was thinking about today is the classical music era ended at some point. They're always classical composers, say in the early 20th century. But, as you're kind of Bach and Brahms and Beethoven and all these kind of people that was the core, Mozart, that was the core of classical music. And it's, or classic rock, right? Now, it doesn't mean that the work dies with it, I mean, the stories that have been published so far are not going anywhere. They're more easy to find today than ever before. You know what I mean? That they're out there and the material is out there. And like you said, you can spend the rest of your life just reading material that's already been published. But the culture is really, really hurting. And I think a lot of it was just, it was overexposure, you know, too many conventions, too many companies, just too much. And you cannot sustain that type of intensity. It's just going to end. And that's kind of what I wanted to talk about. But I also wanted to talk about, you know, all these different movies and just how this influenced the culture. You know, I didn't want it to just be like doom and gloom. You know, I wanted to sort of celebrate the past and, you know, the good things about it, the good things about the industry, the good things about the medium. And you know, there are a lot of good things. You know, I think that goes without saying. And also what I wanted to do, I mean, you're a comics guy. This might be a little before your time, but what I really wanted to sort of base the whole format of the book on is back in the 70s and 80s, there was a magazine called the Comics Journal.
It is before my time. And
Yeah. And that's the cover is kind of like a tribute to that, because I remember the first issue of the Comics Journal I ever got, I was at a flea market, right? And I got it for like 50 cents. And it was this epic interview with John Byrne. And, you know, this is when he was doing the X-Men, right? I think it was like 1980. And that's like, you know, when that stuff hits you, like right age, I guess I was 13 at the time. That hit me just like square in the forehead, you know what I mean? And I never got that out of my system. And I used to actually read, you know, everybody used to read it. Everybody in the business used to read the Comics Journal. Until they lost their minds and they went off into some weird dimension of loser nothingness, you know. But anyhow, I mean, like all this like indie stuff that absolutely nobody reads, you know what I mean? Like that's what they decided to make the focus of their book, and they just killed themselves. It's funny too, because you know, talk about a Gods of Spandex. I got like raked over the coals in the Comics Journal. I mean, this is like... Not the real Comics Journal. I mean, the real Comics Journal died 30 years ago, really. And it just became this corpse, this zombie version of itself. But the guy who wrote the review, he wrote the review, and it was like a year, like almost 2 years after the book came out, because he had come by the blog and like had some problem with something that I was talking about. And like all my read is just like, pig piled on him. They just were like dumping on him. So he's just like, oh, I'll get my revenge. I'll trash this guy's book, you know, in this magazine that absolutely nobody reads.
I mean, you never want to cross a nerd with a lot of time on their hands.
Well, you know, nerd rage is, you know, serial killers, school shooters.
All of the last 3 years, you could say. I mean.
Nerd rage is a very dangerous thing.
The nerds are going to kill us all, as our friend Isaac Weishaupt likes to say. I do want to dig into, like, you touched on a lot of stuff in your book, a lot of stuff that we'll talk about that is sort of favorites of mine in the comic book realm. But you also talked about, so I learned a few things from your book that I had never even knew before. One of them involves Jack Kirby. A few of them involve Jack Kirby. So we touched on him very briefly, I think, the last time you were on the show, but maybe we can dive further into the background of Jack Kirby, his influence on the comic industry a little bit for those that don't really know who that is, for those that don't really follow comics. But I'll let you set up who Jack Kirby is, but there's something really fascinating, the thing with the face, I'll say, that I never knew about that just kind of blew my mind.
Jack Kirby is kind of like the Walt Disney of superhero comics. You know, co-created Captain America, co-created Hulk, Thor, Fantastic Four, you know, was involved in development of Iron Man, was involved in an earlier version of Doctor Strange called Dr. Droom.
That one cracked me up. I had never heard of that before.
Yeah. He just created so many characters. He was like a machine, just... you know, I quoted this guy who I had interviewed who worked with him when Kirby was in animation and said he was like hermetically sealed within his own imagination, you know, but, you know, just full of energy. I mean, he just was constantly creating. Worked with Stan Lee on, you know, the Marvel Age of Comics. Like I said, Fantastic Four, Spider-Man, Doctor Strange, Captain America, Nick Fury, Agent of S.H.I.E.L.D. You know, he had at least had a hand in everything, you know, the classic Marvel age of comics. He either created, co-created, or was involved somewhere on the, you know, usually in the early stages of the development of all these different characters. Like, for instance, he and his partner had created a character called Spider-Man in the 50s. And it, you know, they sort of evolved into this character called the Fly. You know, they just developed the character in a different direction. But, you know, the name Spider-Man was he and his partner who, as I said, co-created Captain America in the 40s. So just unbelievably influential guy, but also incredibly strange, you know, obsessed with paranormal, occult, incredibly obsessed with ufology and ancient astronauts. I mean, ancient astronauts and ufology were like huge obsessions for him.
And you pointed out he was a big ancient astronauts enthusiast even before Von Daniken and Terry of the Gods sort of popularized it. I'm curious, like, what were the sources like that someone like that, like Jack Kirby, would be finding to get him all into that stuff at that, you know, that point in time?
I don't know, man. Late 50s. So he did a lot of stories. There was a company called Harvey, and Harvey published like stuff like Richie Rich and Casper the Friendly Ghost and stuff like that. And he did some science fiction books for them. And there's one issue where it's like he basically invents the X-Men, Planet of the Apes, and Chariots of the Gods, all in one issue of one book. This book called, I think it was called Black Cat or something, Black Cat Mystery. And it's just, he laid the entire groundwork in this one issue of one comic book for all these things. He did a series in the 70s that I was a huge fan of called Commandy, The Last Boy on Earth. And it came about because DC were vying for the license for Planet of the Apes, and they didn't get it. So they said, you know, can you do something like that to develop for an animation cartoon or something? So he did this book called Commandy that I loved to death when I was a kid. But everybody said he was copying Planet of the Apes, and it's like, no, Planet of the Apes was copying him because he came up with that idea, you know, in the late 50s, mid to late 50s. I think it was like 56 or 57. So just extraordinarily creative guy, very strange, clearly very deep into the spectrum, let's just say. Possibly got dosed with LSD at somewhere along the line. Just an amazing, amazing creative genius. There's no second, like there's no runner up in comics. There's nobody who's created as many concepts or characters or ideas or, you know, innovations as him. Like the next runner up is like a distant second. So, but I was into his stuff from like really young, like 5 years old. And, this one comic that I got, in 75, when I think I was like 8 years old, like it changed my life. It was just one of those kind of things where, like, I won't say it's the same as, like, you know, an archaeologist finding the Dead Sea Scrolls, but it, you know, it had like that same kind of transformative effect on my life, and it just totally changed. And it was Commandy, Last Boy on Earth number 30, and it was called UFO, The Wildest Trip Ever. Right. Cause there's a lot of like LSD and acid stuff, even though like he was totally not of that generation. And it's interesting too, because it's about alien abduction. Right. And that's pretty, pretty long before that stuff really became mainstream.
Today's episode of the Mark Claire Show is sponsored by right here, Fox and Sons, foxandsons.com, my favorite coffee brand. And I don't just say that because they're sponsors of the show. I say that because I get a 1 pound bag shipped to my house. The proof is right here. Every single month, I get my pound of Fox and Sons delivered right to my house. You should too. Of course, I don't expect you to just dive right in. no idea what you're getting into, I want you to go get yourself a sample bag. Go over to foxandsons.com, FOXNSONS.com. You can check out the Den Blend Dark, as is my preference, the Tanzanian Peaberry, Brazilian Honey Premp, a bunch of other flavors still to come. Steven's always mixing it up with new, fresh beans. The best part about this business, Steven started it to not only relive his love for sharing coffee with his father, but to teach his own sons about entrepreneurship. If that doesn't give you the warm and fuzzies, I don't know what will. Just kidding. Yes, I do. This coffee will. So head over to foxandsons.com, FOXNSONS.com. Use discount code MCS to get yourself 18% off your order. You're going to be coming back for more. Trust me. Foxandsons.com, discount code MCS. Back to the show. Yeah, and then what really blew my mind is that panel from that one comic, The Face on Mars, where Jack Kirby very, very accurately portrayed what would sometime later, I don't know, a decade or two later, be a very similar image of what people call the face on Mars, this image from Mars, from like the Viking, whatever, one of those probes. But this was way before that. Viking one, that's what it is. Yeah. But this drawing, even I think they even called it the face on Mars in the book. That blew my mind. So I don't know. What do you think is going on there? Did Jack Kirby have some insights that we might not be aware of?
Well, that's, you know, the thing is that that's the tip of the iceberg with him. He anticipated or remote viewed or had some sort of, I used to call him the space age Nostradamus. You know, he just had that sense. I mean, he just could sort of, I don't even know how to describe it. He prophesied things that, that he shouldn't have known about. And the face on Mars is one of them. I mean, of course, that raises the chicken and the egg argument. Like, you know, was that a real object or did somebody, was there some Jack Kirby fan at NASA? I mean, I don't know.
Yeah, maybe maybe NASA made the face on Mars from Jack Kirby. That might be most believable explanation.
Well, either way, like I said, that's just the tip of the iceberg. He anticipated a lot of crazy stuff. And actually there's a story that he did in the late 50s, I think in that same series. No, it was in Alarming Tales, that was like very weirdly in a very strange cartoony sci-fi way, kind of about how Jack Parsons met Marjorie Cameron, you know, which is like something that nobody knew about until the 70s when Kenneth Grant published The Magical Revival.
So he was certainly some kind of insider of some sorts, you would think. Or maybe he was accessing, you know, the Akashic Record, or something was going on. Let's put it that way.
I mean, listen, I'm a firm believer in all that kind of thing. You know, I believe that we have, or some of us at least, have ways of accessing information that's beyond normal human comprehension. That's something I take for granted. And a lot of it, you know, like I used to do a lot of stuff on him in the blog before, you know, the Marvel movies became like the sort of dominant cultural icons that they became. And it was kind of funny because like I could tell like a lot of people like, why, you know, shut up about this guy. Why do you keep talking about this guy? And then sure enough, you know, a couple years later, it's like the Marvel universe basically took control of the multiplexes. And I would say to people, see, you know, see what I was talking about? See what I meant? You know, so, you know, there you go.
Yeah, certainly a fascinating person, whether it's inside the pages of the book or outside. And there's definitely a progression as well in his art. I don't know if it was like you said, if he just started dabbling or got dosed with acid or what, but it's like at some point in the 60s, suddenly we've got the Celestials, we've got the New Gods, we've got all this space age wild giant creatures. I mean, it's basically just a representation of, like you said, a lot of the modern sort of ancient aliens type stuff only decades before. So it just continues to fascinate that he was so much ahead of stuff that, I mean, is now. I mean, that stuff is essentially pushed by our government and our mainstream media at this point. But back then, it was much more subversive.
Yes, it was. And it was also incredibly marginal. So, all right. So, Chariots of the Gods comes out in the late what year?
I think it was 67 like, or thereabouts.
Well, it came out in Germany in 66, and then I think it was published in this country in like 68, somewhere like that. Just look it up. Yeah. And I mean, that book was huge for a long time, you know, and then he published a bunch of sequels to it and so on. That book was very, very popular up until, I would say, like the early, like 72, 73, 74, around there. And then they kind of just fell away, even though people were writing, you know, books similar to that. And I think in 75 was when Sitchin, no, 76 was when Zechariah Sitchin wrote The 12th Planet. And that kind of redefined the whole ancient, like the whole ancient astronaut thing was very much popularized by von Däniken. But at least for the, you know, the 90s, the whole 90s scene, like the whole Sitchin thing was really, you know, that was the predominant.
Right, because von Däniken would point out, you know, would point out a lot of the weird things. He'd say, look at this architecture, this must be aliens, look at this, look at that. But Sitchin supposedly interpreted the actual writings and said, no, look, here's the whole story. Like, I've actually got the tale. So for people in that realm, it's like, it's almost like they got the cohesive story they were looking for.
Yeah. But, you know, I don't think people really talk about Sitchin anymore. That was big. Like David Icke was a real big fan of that stuff and kind of took that under his belt and made that part of his whole spiel. Jim Mars was, you know, big follower of Sitchin. There was a book that was very popular in conspiracy circles back in the day. I don't think people even remember it now. There's a book called Gods of Eden by a guy named William Bramley. That was very much part of that whole Sitchin-esque, you know, the Sumerians and so on. But he died, gosh, when did he die? Like, I'm tempted to say 2011 that he died. But at that point, Ancient Aliens, you know, that was such a phenomenon for so many years. And that was, you know, basically von Däniken fanfic. You know what I'm saying? It was like there was this bunch of guys like William Henry and David Wilcock and David Childress and all these people just like kissing von Däniken's ass. Of course, Giorgio. Yes. And
everyone's favorite.
Giorgio Tsoukalos. He worked for von Däniken. That's how he sort of rose to fame. And it's so weird because I was thinking about this tonight. All this crap with, you know, Grouch and Elizondo and Tom DeLonge. Mm-hmm. I mean, that just made all that stuff so incredibly uncool. Right. It's like,
yeah, for however cool Jack Kirby made this stuff look, I think it's the opposite is happening now.
Yeah. It's such a normie thing now, but I remember like back in 2017 or so, maybe it was 2016, because, you know, Hillary Clinton was talking about UFOs and John Podesta was talking about UFOs and then Tom DeLonge comes along with his whole boondoggle. You know what I mean? And he just, you know, I mean, I think Tom DeLonge's very, very talented. I'm a big fan of Angels and Airwaves because it's kind of like hitting those buttons of the music that I listened to when I was young. But he was a terrible choice to push that whole agenda. And he just made it just so incredibly uncool. And here we are, you know. I mean, I just stopped. I was writing a lot about ufology and ancient aliens and stuff. And then it's like I snapped out of it. Like somebody came out and just slapped me in the head and goes, snap out of it.
You don't want to be associated with these guys, that's for sure.
No.
Well,
no.
I want to move on to discuss you discuss a number of my favorite personal creators in this book. So I want to touch on a few of them and some of their sort of a cultural slash occult significance. I think I have to start with one of my all-time favorite creators, and really specifically because of the character that you do bring up. That's Mike Mignola and Hellboy. So tell me a little bit about Hellboy. I think it first came out in the early 90s. So it's somewhat modern compared to a lot of the stuff you talk about in the book, but take it away on Hellboy.
Yeah, so that was about 93. So Mike Mignola, he started working at Marvel. He did actually the first Rocket Raccoon miniseries, I believe. And then I started to notice his work because he did a book called Cosmic Odyssey, which is very Kirby-esque. It was kind of like JLA versus the New Gods kind of deal. Have you ever seen Cosmic Odyssey?
I have not.
Familiar with that? Oh, you should look. It's a great series. You should definitely check that out. And the art is phenomenal. And then he did a book. He really made his bones with fandom. He did a book called Gotham by Gaslight, which was kind of like the steampunk version of Batman. And that book was a huge hit. Huge hit. Everybody I knew, you know, who's reading comics and stuff, read that Gotham by Gaslight. And that got him the gig. He did production design for Francis Ford Coppola's Dracula movie. And he also did production design for Disney's Atlantis. That's a movie that nobody remembers. That movie just kind of came and went. But he created this character. So what happened is that all the big DC and Marvel artists quit. A lot of them, to start Image. Back in, that was 92. So it was like Jim Lee, Mark Silvestri, Eric Larson, Wills Patricio.
Rob Liefeld's the other big one, yeah.
Liefeld did Youngblood. So everybody, all the Marvel's top artists just quit at once and started this company. So then all these other publishers were sort of scrambling to do their own version of that. And Dark Horse started an imprint called Legend. And they had like John Byrne and so on. And that's where Mike Mignola created Hellboy for. And Hellboy is just basically, I mean, it's pretty much a copy, you know, kind of almost outright of Jack Kirby's The Demon, right? And you know, it was basically the same idea. It was like a demon that fought for good. You know what I'm saying? And in this case, it was a demon that had been summoned up by like Nazi sorcerers in the waning days of the war, and was put to work, you know, basically kind of like an occult detective thing. And like, I think in the first storyline, I think it was like versus Rasputin. Maybe like
in the comic, yeah.
Was that what it was?
That was he was one of the like the ones who summoned him to the Earth.
Yeah, was that the Conqueror Worm? Was that what it was called?
I think that's the second or third storyline. But yeah, I mean that was the main arc of that first arc was all with Rasputin.
Okay, well either way, so he starts Hellboy, and it's very very well done as far as. His research is just top notch, and he didn't like just make shit up. I mean, he went back into the lore, and that was the basis of his stories, right? It was occult lore from like the Middle Ages and stuff. And he was also big into Lovecraft, so there's a huge kind of Lovecraft influence there as well. But, you know, they did make some movies, none of which I liked.
Definitely avoid. I mean, the Guillermo del Toro ones are at least visually kind of cool. But, story-wise, they're lacking, you could say.
But it's the exact opposite. See, so Hellboy is about quiet and eerie and creepy. And del Toro is about...
Did you know a 2018 study showed half of prenatal vitamins tested had unacceptable levels of heavy metals? I'm Kat, mother of three and founder of Ritual. When I was 4 months pregnant, I couldn't find a prenatal I could trust, so I created my own. Ours is made traceable, third-party tested for heavy metals, and recently earned the Purity Award from the Clean Label Project. But don't just take my word for it. Get 25% off at ritual.com/podcast.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Big loud and jump scares.
Yeah, they don't match the tone of the comics at all.
At all. They did an animated version that was a little closer, and they actually adopted some of this or adapted some of the stories for the one was called Blood and Iron, and I forget what the other one. Like, there was a direct to DVDs and stuff, and they were pretty good. Like, they were pretty entertaining, but nothing matches the comic books, because the comic books are just so eerie. It almost seems like you're reading somebody's dreams, like you're sort of eavesdropping on somebody's dreams, and it's really very, very effective in that regard.
And you can tell Mignola is very well read and understood when it comes to lore, mythology, occult symbolism, because it is just it is just strewn throughout, and in no way done randomly. Everything that he puts in there is done with purpose, and it's very clear that he has a very, I don't really know his personal background, but he clearly has a deep knowledge of this stuff.
He does. He stopped drawing it, you know, several years ago. And the only artist that I really thought captured his mood was a guy named Richard Corbin. And Richard Corbin was a guy who I was a big fan of when I was like a little kid, and I should have been reading Richard Corbin comics because it was all underground comics. And he did a lot of stuff for, I don't know if you know Creepy and Eerie, those magazines from the 70s. Have you ever heard of those? You too young?
So. Just a little.
God, just shoot me in the head right now.
Sounds like there's a lot of good stuff I got to go out and find, you know?
Yeah, and that stuff. So it started off being like Creepy and Eerie started off sort of doing like the whole EC, you know, EC yeah. Comics are. So they're trying to do like EC Comics, and then they kind of really went in their own direction. They also published Vampirella. Mm-hmm.
That one.
You familiar with that character? Yeah. So
trust me, if you were a teenage boy at a 90s comic convention, you knew who Vampirella was.
Yeah. So, so Richard Corbin did some great stories, and his stuff is very eerie, but it's eerie in a different way. There was a book, or at least an arc that he did for Hellboy called The Crooked Man. Have you ever read The Crooked Man, yep. That arc? Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that's Richard Corbin. Corbin did a lot of work for, he did a lot of work for Marvel and DC in like the early 2000s. He did, he did a couple arcs on Hellblazer, John Constantine Hellblazer. He did a Hulk miniseries. He did a Luke Cage miniseries. I was just always a real big fan of his stuff. He did a lot of work for Heavy Metal in the 80s. I don't know if anybody's familiar with that book, but
One character you mentioned there provides a pretty good segue into another creator that I wanted to talk about that you spend a good amount of time on in the book for good reason. He's one of the most prolific and well-known comic creators out there. He's also a self-professed and very, very open black magic occult magician. That is one Mr. Alan Moore, someone whose work has been some of my favorites over the years. It doesn't all strike with me. It's kind of, he has several different styles. I actually prefer a lot of his superhero work over some of his other weirder stuff, but his Swamp Thing is still number one to me too. So, but where do you start with Alan Moore? Because he's certainly a very, very interesting character in his own right, besides the characters he writes.
So we're coming up on the, I guess we passed the 40th anniversary when I first started reading Alan Moore, because I was reading Saga of the Swamp Thing when I think I was probably one of the few people in the world that was reading that book. They, in 1982, they did a Swamp Thing movie with Adrian Barbeau, and I think Louis Jourdan was in it. A guy named Dick Durock played the Swamp Thing. Terrible movie. But DC relaunched Swamp Thing, which I was a huge fan of in the 70s. Relaunched Swamp Thing. And since I was, you know, so into the character, I was just buying the book every month. And it was okay. There was nothing wrong with it. But then Alan Moore starts writing it. You know, he comes over from England. He was writing for Warrior, mythology series. That's where he did like V for Vendetta, and I think Marvel Man was in Warrior. I think Marvel Man was in Warrior. And then he did another series called the Bo Jeffrey Saga. I don't know if you're familiar with these.
Only from those are only ones I know about from reading your book. Yeah.
Yeah. So he came over and did the Swamp Thing. And I was just blown away from the very first, like the very first issue was kind of, he was just wrapping up this other storyline. Right. And it just sucked me right in. And then he did this, the second issue he did is world famous among, you know, hardcore comics guys. It was a story called The Anatomy Lesson. Mm-hmm. And that kind of rebooted the entire character. I mean, he just totally changed the whole thrust of the storyline. And I was just, I couldn't wait for those issues to come out. I kind of lost interest, I'd say, you know, a couple years after I started. Like, so I started reading his stuff in October, this month, probably around this time of the month, 40 years ago. And then he did this like menstruating werewolf story. And I was just like,
that sounds like a very Alan Moore-esque story.
Yeah. I was just like, no, thank you. I thought he just lost his inspiration for the character, which happens, you know, it wasn't his character and stuff. And then he did The Watchmen, which my wife was a fan of. Like, I wasn't reading that title when it was coming out, rather erratically. Because I, at the time, my two big books were, I was obsessed with Love and Rockets, and that's when Miller was doing The Dark Knight Returns, which to me was like, I can't tell you how many times I read those stories over and over again. I would read one of those issues and then like read it again like three or four times in a row. I was just so, if you want to know what 1986 was like, just read The Dark Knight Returns. He just captures the zeitgeist so brilliantly. And that book just blew me away. And I remember reading like Watchmen. And I was thinking, yeah, you know, it was too intellectual. It was too conceptual. It just didn't have that like punch you in the stomach kind of feeling that the Frank Miller stuff had. But, you know, I did read the whole thing. And then he got into a tiff with DC over the rights to Watchmen. And he started doing like a bunch of, he did this thing called A Small Killing, which I just thought was horrible. And then he did this thing called Big Numbers with Bill Sienkiewicz that he did like two issues of, and then somebody else did it. He was just doing all this like really obscure stuff. And then he did From Hell, which, you know, was the basis of the Johnny Depp movie. And I really, really hated the artwork in From Hell.
Really?
A guy named Eddie Campbell. Yeah. And I mean, I did read the whole thing. You know, I did read the whole book later in a trade paperback collection. And it's based on this whole like Masonic conspiracy, this book called, there's a guy named Stephen A. Knight. It was like, I think it was called like The Final Secret of Jack the Ripper. And it was this whole thing about that, the Prince of Wales had knocked up some prostitute and the killings were all to sort of silence everyone who knew about it. You know, so you've seen the movie, that's kind of like the basis of the whole storyline. I liked it okay. But I really hated the artwork. And then he did a bunch of stuff for Rob Liefeld over at Rob Liefeld quit Image, and did he start Awesome? Wasn't it called
first? Yeah, well, he started Awesome Comics as a side label when he still was at Image, which really pissed people off. And then once he broke away, he went all the way to Awesome, and then he turned Awesome into Maximum Press. But yeah, Alan Moore did a run with him on Supreme, which I've actually been going through for my other podcast on Second Print Comics. I've been going through that series, which I really enjoy his Supreme work myself.
Well, the stuff that really, you know, when I felt like I kind of like got back on his wavelength was when he did America's Best Comics. Mm-hmm. He did Promethea and Tom Strong and Top 10, which I think was that a movie? I think that was a movie. I'm not sure. I really liked that stuff, but it was the same kind of deal because Promethea I really liked a lot. And then like halfway through the run, it just becomes like, you know, I call it Theosophist summer camp. It was just like,
yeah, that phrase had me cracking up in the book.
Yeah. It wasn't even a story anymore. It was just like his little dissertation on the tarot and the Kabbalah and everything. And I just thought, you know, if I want to read this stuff, I'll read like the actual source material. I don't want to read like, you know, some your Wonder Woman ripoff walking through Aleister Crowley land. You know, it just was so dumb. It just really, really turned me off. But then what he did is he did a book for Avatar called The Courtyard. And then he did another series, a sequel to that, called Neonomicon, which was kind of like his take on Lovecraft. Well, both of them were his take on Lovecraft, you know, very influenced by a story that he'd written for a book called, I think it was called The Starry Wisdom. I think that's where he originally wrote The Courtyard for. But anyhow, it was clear to me that, so he did this book and he came right out and said, I did this book because, you know, I had a tax bill that I had to pay and I needed some money. That's why I did Neonomicon. But I thought it was great. And it was so clearly an X-Files pitch that he wrote.
Mm-hmm. Some of the scenes too. I mean, you kind of shared one of the screenshots of you know, from that book, and it's literally an X-Files scene. I mean, it's Mulder and Scully.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, when you read that book and think this is Mulder and Scully and Doggett, like John Doggett, it's so obvious to me. Because back in like the fifth season of the X-Files, like Stephen King wrote an episode and William Gibson wrote an episode. William Gibson wrote an episode in the seventh season too. So I think Alan Moore's thinking, hey, I can do that. And it just seems so obvious to me. Like he had a tax bill to pay. He's like, shit, what do I get to publish? Oh, I have this X-Files pitch. I'll just change the names of the characters and put it out in the comic book. Oh, the other thing that I should mention too is League of Extraordinary Gentlemen. I thought that was phenomenal, especially those first three or four series. Oh my God. I just thought, like, I thought that this was like the best, like heroic adventure stuff ever done. I mean, I think Alan Moore is a genius. I really do. The one thing though, is that, and that I sort of go to length to point out in the book is that all of his stories and characters and stuff are all revisions of other people's characters. I mean, the one thing about Alan Moore is that, like, he doesn't create his own stuff. What he does is he'll take somebody else's idea and improve on it. You know what I mean?
Yeah, or giving a different angle or a different take or flipping the whole thing around. But it's his finest work. Even Watchmen, those aren't really original characters. They're just kind of takes on these other those Charlton characters as well.
So what had happened is that DC had gotten so Charlton went out of business, and Charlton's another story. That whole story hasn't been written, but that was like basically a mob run outfit. And basically they just published comic books as money laundering. Seriously. It's a really fascinating story. And a lot of people won't come out and talk about it, but they'll sort of allude to it. Like they'll sort of like, you know, make a little hints and stuff. But anyhow, they had a bunch of characters like Blue Beetle, which was just a big flop movie recently, and all these Peacemaker with John, I think John Cena is doing now. So DC bought the rights, and Moore said, you know, I want to do this thing, you know, this thing called Watchmen with them. And they said, no, we paid a lot of money for these characters. You're not going to sit there and ruin them for us, you know, with your weird, perverted left
wing. We didn't buy these characters so you could have them raping each other, Alan.
Yeah. So, And the other thing, the one book that I should mention that I didn't really go into a lot of depth in this book on, because it's a comic book, but it's not so much a superhero comic book, was Providence. Did you read Providence?
I'm not.
Providence is phenomenal. That is like, I think that's pretty much the last thing he's done for comics. And if it is, that's like a great way to go out. You know, it's kind of like how Bowie went out with Black Star. It's just, it's a great farewell, let's just say.
Do you think like Alan Moore, because he does openly talk about black magic and using magic and something he's very immersed in, do you think that he actually views his his efforts and his creative output in the comic book industry as some sort of form of magic? Or is it just something that he's so interested in that it is just naturally, well, in some ways naturally bleeds into his work, in other ways, such as in Promethea, where it's, you know, Theosophy Summer Camp, not so naturally, but is it more just a thing he's into? Or do you think he actually is trying to do some of it there?
No, he's pretty clear that, you know, like, doing these stories is part of his magical practice.
Have you ever heard, I'm not sure if you ever heard about this, but have you ever heard, you know, because he's, as you mentioned earlier, he's one of the creator, or I think he is the creator of Hellblazer, John Constantine, I believe he is. And
yeah, he created him for Swamp Thing.
Right, exactly. Who's basically, he's basically like a black magic occult detective, I guess you could say. And there have been stories, not just from Alan Moore, but from many creators who have worked on Hellblazer, that they have encountered someone seemingly like the character of Hellblazer in real life, who has said Hellblazer-esque, John Constantine-esque things to them. And more than one creator has said that. And that story has always just fascinated me. It makes you wonder if, did they create Hellblazer, or did Hellblazer use them to be inserted into the comic book realm?
Or maybe this external version of Constantine is a tulpa.
Perhaps. There you go.
You know what I mean? But see, the thing is that when he created Hellblazer or Constantine, you know, Hellblazer was the name of the title. You know, he didn't create a character called Hellblazer. But, you know, he said that he based that character on, like, you know, these kind of characters that he knew that sort of, he was like friends with the guys from Bauhaus and so on. And so he was sort of in that kind of those circles, like kind of counterculture, underground punk circles. And he said that he just always, you know, the occultists that he met weren't like Dr. Strange. They were like these, you know, these scumbag grifters, you know? And that's really where Constantine comes from. And the interesting thing too is that visually he was based on Sting. I don't know if you knew that.
Yes.
Yeah. It was funny too, because that was at a time when the police were like, you know, you couldn't turn on the radio without hearing a police song. And I just remember seeing that and just thought, come on. No, are you kidding me? Seriously?
I can't believe they did a Constantine movie and didn't cast Sting as Constantine. Blows my mind.
Yeah. Everybody loves Keanu Reeves, but he was not. That was not the guy that I would have cast.
That was not Keanu. That's not the Keanu we know now anyway, but bad casting for what that character is supposed to be. One more character I do want to talk character. I say character, but really creator, but I suppose he's another character in his own right. And it's a creator. Some of his work I like, some of his work I can't stand. So it's kind of touch and go for me, but he's a really interesting character in the context of the subjects we've been discussing. So I think we'd be remiss not to discuss Grant Morrison a bit as well. Also comes from sort of that British sort of punk scene. So there's probably some overlap there, but I'll get to the most interesting part about Grant Morrison in a second that I pulled from your book, but why don't you just set up a little bit of his backstory and what he's put into comics?
Well, so what happened is that there was a comic scene in England in the early 80s, because there was, like I said, Warrior, and there was another series called 2000 AD, which, Judge Dredd ran in, and, you know, it was just, there was a lot of kind of stuff going on. It was a very small scene, but, you know, a lot of talent. And after Alan Moore became such a big hit, this editor at DC called Karen Berger went over there, and she just basically just scooped everyone up. And this is where you had Dave Gibbons and Neil Gaiman. Grant Morrison was definitely one of them. Peter Milligan, Brendan McCarthy. Who else? Just a lot of just basically took the cream of the crop. Alan Davis, who you know, became a big fan favorite when he worked on JLA and so on. So just took everyone and basically kind of killed the British comic scene overnight. You know, it just sort of sucked all the oxygen out. And Grant Morrison was one of the one of her finds. And he started. I remember a lot of his early stuff I really did like. He started on Animal Man, I think it was. And that was in Vertigo. So basically, Karen Berger just created like this entire imprint for all these artists and writers that she took from England. It was called Vertigo. And Sandman became part of that. I mean, Sandman, which is a series on Netflix now, that was their bestseller. I mean, people forget that book was big. That book outsold, I think that was like DC's bestseller at one point. I think it outsold everything except for like Batman and JLA. So Grant Morrison was one of them. And Grant Morrison is a self-creation, I guess you would say. He did this book called The Invisibles that he said was being dictated to him by extraterrestrials that he had come into contact with in Nepal.
That's the one. That's the interesting point that I pulled out.
He said
that in interviews that he was in Nepal and encountered an alien race that dictated this story to him. He's actually said this.
Yeah, he did say that. He says a lot of stuff like that. That's not even the most outrageous thing he's ever said. And then when DC was about to cancel that book, he did the little wankathon.
Oh yeah, you gotta, I mean, not describe it in detail, but you gotta tell people about this because this was I had never heard this one before.
Okay, so this is really interesting because he did a Justice League revamp. I think around 96 or so, and it became like DC's biggest hit. It was like top five, top 10 book every month. It was a huge book. But he was also doing like all this weird stuff for Vertigo. And one of these series he was doing was The Invisibles, which was just like clearly a story that he was just making up as he went along. I mean, there was no narrative thread. It was just like whatever he was reading or thinking about that month, he'd make a story about. I mean, it's just like, I mean, some of it is really good. I mean, some of those stories are really good, but it was so obvious that he was just making the shit up as he went along, that it was just.
Or that the alien race was making it up as they went along.
It was clearly just a lark for him. So they canceled the book, and then when he started doing, when he started doing JLA, you know, he got them to reboot it, and then it was in danger of cancellation again because it just wasn't selling that well. And what he did in the letters pages of the book is he said, I think it was on New Year's Eve, he wanted everyone to focus on the sigil that he printed in the letters page and pull one out. Basically, squeeze one out, you know, while you're sort of meditating on this. That's what I call him the wank commander. but it quote unquote worked. DC revived for another 12 issues. That was a countdown to 1999, I think it was, or the year 2000, something like that.
And the idea is that everyone was supposed to focus on this like certain sigil or symbol while performing this wankathon at the exact same time, which is supposed to create some sort of magical influence on the world.
Mm-hmm. Yes, exactly. And but then he quit DC and went to Marvel and did an X-Men reboot.
Did it work, by the way? Popular. Did we ever get any reports on the results of the
well, the results was is that the you know he wanted the whole purpose of this was to get the Invisibles renewed again, and it was renewed again, but I don't think it had anything to do with his his little ritual there. I think it had more to do with the DC wanted to just keep him happy.
I guess we can't prove that it didn't, so
we can't prove that it didn't, but I don't know, man. So he's done some good stuff, but he was always, he put himself in this competition with Alan Moore, and he's just not in Alan Moore's league as a creator. He just isn't. I mean, Alan Moore has created icons, you know, the smiley face with the splash of blood on it that people like who had no idea what the Watchmen were. I mean, I would see people wearing that pin at like punk rock shows and stuff, had no idea what the Watchmen was, but that became like, that was a real sigil, right? And then the when the whole Anonymous thing was big, the Guy Fawkes masks from V for Vendetta. Yeah. So, I mean, Grant Morrison is a very entertaining guy. You know, he seems to be a little depleted. He seems to be a little broken these days, which I guess is just inevitable because that industry just chews people up and spits them out. But he's not even fit to, you know, polish Alan Moore's wand. You know what I mean? He's not in the same league. And, you know, that's no dig against him, really, because nobody is. You know, I mean, like I said, Jack Kirby was like, that's the king of the superhero creators. And like for everything else is Alan Moore. So it's just like, that's why I kind of focused on them in a lot of ways in the book, because it's just like Jack Kirby and then Alan Moore. I mean, that's the story of the whole comic book culture phenomenon. You know what I mean? Those are the two guys that really made it happen. And there's just, you know, for what Moore does, there's a very distant second. For what Kirby did, there's a very distant second. I mean, you talk about Kirby as the king of the superhero comics and Alan Moore sort of the king of everything else, you know, all the weirdo kind of occult, whatever.
And if we could fantasy a book, you know, a creative team that could never actually happen, Alan Moore writing a Jack Kirby book, that's what I want to see. Just let them loose in their prime.
Well, I know that Alan Moore wanted to. I know at one point, see, the problem was that Kirby had a lot of health problems. He started having a lot of problems with his eyes, like in the 70s. And everybody was sort of, you know, pointing out that his drawing skills had really suffered. But it was because he was having a lot of physical problems. I think he had a heart attack. And then in the 80s, I know that he had a stroke, like a really serious stroke. And he developed a tremor. And he just couldn't. He couldn't do it anymore. I mean, he tried. He did. He was still doing a lot of work for both animation and comics. I mean, the guy was just a workhorse. But I do know that Moore wanted to do something with Kirby, but Kirby just wasn't up to it. He wasn't healthy enough. He just couldn't do the work. So it never happened. But that would have been, you know, something interesting to see.
For sure. Well, Chris, one more thing I want to get your thoughts on, and then we'll head over to the smoke-filled room and get a little weirder here. But you know, you talked about your main premise here is that this era is winding down. The cultural phenomenon known as superheroes is fading away. I don't think the comic medium is fading away, and there'll probably always be
will
always exist. And there's always interesting stuff out there is the good thing, because the medium is one thing, and the medium will always remain, and there's always going to be things interesting. You might have to dig a little further to find them sometimes. But nonetheless, I'm curious, as this culture phenomenon dies, I don't know if it's going to be a slow, silent death or go out with a big bloody bang, but either way, I'm curious what you see it being replaced with. Do you think this is a phenomenon, a modern mythology that sort of became in many ways to people that didn't have religion, almost like their own religion, almost like something that is what drove their own mythos? So do you see that being replaced with something else, and what may that be?
I don't think that you could ever replace you can't fill the same space that, like, say, the Marvel Universe filled from like 2008 to 2019 or 20 or so. That space can never be refilled. You can never, that's a point in time that I don't think you can replicate. Because things are just too, you know, first of all, Hollywood isn't just very, very serious trouble. Very, very serious trouble. And I don't think people really understand, you know, because so many movies were losing so much money for so many years. And it was like the Marvel movies were making so much money that they're just basically keeping Disney afloat. And with the end of the Marvel Universe, as we knew it, I mean, Disney is circling the drain right now. I mean, just read the news. I mean, everybody's talking about how their stock just completely collapsed, and they're talking about just basically selling off their assets and then just selling Disney as a IP farm to Apple, which is like, I can't even imagine that. Comic books in a lot of ways are more popular than ever because of manga and YA. Mm. I mean, kids, I think there are more kids reading comics today than were like when I was a kid. I mean, I didn't know anybody besides myself when until I got to high school that read comics except for me. Like there were, I think there were a couple kids who were into them for a little while and then kind of got out of it. But like I was the only person I knew until I got to high school that was like heavily into comics. None of my friends were, you know, none of the kids in the neighborhood were. It was just invisible. So it was really kind of almost a miraculous thing that it became so dominant. And, you know, you can't discount the effect that the first Batman movie had. But to see the first Batman movie basically was almost like a one-off because they, you know, you saw a lot of movies like Dick Tracy and The Phantom and The Shadow. And they were trying to sort of recapture that lightning in a bottle. And then Batman ends up with that stupid bat nipples, Batman and Robin the Clooney movie, nipples, right? Yeah. It just basically killed it until I think it was 2000, 2001 when the first X-Men movie came out. But even then, I mean, the whole superhero thing did not take off until 2008, right? So almost 20 years after the first Batman movie, when you had The Dark Knight and Iron Man, that's real. That's, you know, if you want to pinpoint when it really took off, and I published A Gods with Spandex just before that, like a few months before it really, you know, the shit really hit the fan. So I don't know. You know, the other problem too is that there just aren't enough kids anymore. You know, no matter how many adults read comics, I mean, that's, if you took all the adults that read comics, I mean, it's always been about maybe like a quarter of a million people in this country, at least. But the amount of kids who watched the X-Men cartoon in like the 90s, I mean, what, 10, 15 million kids used to watch that cartoon every month, every week. You know, the movies. I mean, the comic books themselves have always been almost incidental to the real popularity of superheroes, which is movies, cartoons, TV shows, toys, games. That kind of thing.
Well, I guess we will see. Maybe it'll be, maybe everyone will rally around, you know, our space brothers descending down or whatnot. Maybe they'll be our new heroes, but only time will tell. Chris, we'll dig a little bit further into some of these concepts in the Smoke-Filled Room segment in just a minute. Before we wind down though, just let everybody know where they can find all your work and whatnot. But I do want to also say though, this book, The Spandex Files, I really want to recommend picking it up, not just for the written content, but as you kind of mentioned, it is very, it's done in a very visually pleasing way. And it's really a fun read. And I when I say an easy read, I don't mean that it's, you know, it's not deep. It has its sort of deep elements, you could say, but it feels good to read because it's done in a way that continues to, you know, it sort of makes it feel fun along the way. So I just want to commend you for how the book is done and recommend people check that out.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Spandex Files is available on Amazon in both soft cover and hardcover. And I got to tell you something, Amazon hardcovers are beautiful. They're so nice. They're so crisp. They're so just really nice books. So I would recommend that you get it in hardcover. It's not a book that I'm going to do an ebook of because it really doesn't, you know, how the book is laid out and everything. It doesn't really lend itself to that format. But secretsun.blogspot.com is, you know, you can always find me there and secretsun.blog or secretsunblog on Twitter. Secret Sun Speaks. So.
All right. Well, it's the farewell to the superheroes, but it's certainly not a farewell to your work. So continue to follow Chris over at the Secret Sun blog. Chris, thanks so much for coming on my show.
Thank you.